Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Zachariah Hughes, and today we're talking about disasters, emergencies, and what preparatory steps are in place across the state and that might mitigate a calamity if something really bad does happen. This past weekend, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake in Cook Inlet rattled much of South Central Alaska awake, but without any loss of life and minimal destruction to property. The event inspired many Alaskans to double check that they'd stocked up on water and batteries and got the rest of us to look around the room for adults to beg for guidance. And I'm lucky to be joined by three of those SAGE advisors. Here with me is Steve Rebuffo, director of the Port of Anchorage, a major point of access for a lot of the goods and commodities coming in through the state. Kelly McGuirk with the Red Cross, and Mike O'Hare with the state's Division of Homeland Security. And Mike, I want to just start out right with you. How big of a deal was this earthquake?
It was a very big deal. It was a 7.1 lesson that Mother Nature gave us to help us reflect on, are we truly prepared for a disaster? We got lucky. There was no major damage, no injuries or death, and no critical infrastructure damage.
Now, was that because it was so far removed from a population center, or?
It was the dynamics and the situation of the earthquake, and I'm not an earthquake scientist, but we usually become one in our business. And so where the epicenter was, how deep it was, had a lot to do with the lack of damage, but we got lucky. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, I just want to pull up something that you were quoted as saying earlier this week on Channel 2, and it starts out, "We got lucky. A seismic event like this highlights how vulnerable we are since most of Alaska's food and fuel crosses our docks. We're going to do further inspections as tide and weather allows."
Right.
And I just want to ask, was that because you guys were worried about port infrastructure after the quake, or because of the magnitude of the quake itself?
Well, both. I mean, we always get concerned when there's a shaker of any size. This one was a real attention getter for everybody down there. I mean, you know, Mike said we got lucky. I have to agree with that. One of the container ships that was inbound for a Sunday offload was 2 hours out. Things could have got a lot more interesting if it was at the dock. And the fact that the 7.1 earthquake was as far away as it was and as deep as it was mitigated some of what could have been some real concerns. I mean, while we have surface level infrastructure, we have a lot of petroleum plumbing underground that concerns us too.
Yeah. And how is the Port of Anchorage a little bit different, not just in size, but in its geography and some of its assets compared to some of the other ports in the Gulf of Alaska?
Sure. Well, we're probably more eclectic with respect to the business model that we have down there. I mean, a lot of ports are focused on one particular type of commodity or product line. Because of how important this port is to the state, we handle containerized goods, dry bulk goods, petroleum products, and we have infrastructure that covers the gamut of what it takes to be responsible for managing all of that. So there's a lot to look at, and there's a lot that port users own that has to get looked at as well when something like this happens.
And Kelly, as early as kind of Sunday morning, what was Red Cross doing down on the Kenai Peninsula?
Well, we got the notification pretty much as the earth was shaking and knew that we were going to get some phone calls. And so our local disaster program manager here started making some phone calls to get some volunteers mobilized pretty quickly. And we didn't know the extent of the damage or if there was any damage to the roads, and so felt it was unsafe to send them that night, but sent them first thing the next morning on Sunday morning. We had to send some volunteers here from Anchorage and from the Mat-Su Valley to go and support the shelter. Shelter was opened by the National Guard Armory, or the National Guard was running it initially, and then we took over operations probably around 1 or 2 in the afternoon.
And I remember during the Sockeye Fire, Red Cross had a big imprint up or in the Willow area and in the Mat-Su Valley. And I'm just curious if you guys have a shelter model in place with each individual community, or if it's more of a, you know, one size fits all model that you're bringing with you.
Yeah, it's a great question. We have a couple different models of shelters. So in some locations, communities decide that they want to run shelters on their own. They don't want to follow a Red Cross model. In some communities, they would like to just have our support. So whether that's us sending staff to them or registration forms or food, depending on how those conversations go in the planning process. And then in other communities, such as Anchorage, we're going to run the shelters. And we know exactly what the protocol is and have the volunteer base and everything in place.
Mike, how is capacity for disaster response distributed across the state? Is everything sort of stockpiled in hubs like Anchorage and Fairbanks, or is there really a lot of capacity and expertise spread across?
Well, I think there's a lot of capacity and expertise focused in the larger communities. I won't say I'm not worried about the remote rural communities. They're used to getting cut off on supplies and processing, preserving fish and game and being prepared, better prepared for disasters. It's in the urban communities of Alaska that we're most focused on with a catastrophic event like this. In Lower 48, it's a disaster if the cable goes out. In a situation here in Anchorage, we want to focus on the shelter capacities and focus on individual and family preparedness, what to do, what not to do in a situation like the 7.1 earthquake.
So how is your planning different in a, you know, on the rail belt compared to some place that's drastically more remote? And I'm thinking, you know, Point Lay or Galena or Macquarie.
Sure. So with regards to preparedness in an urban community, we want to make sure and ensure that the municipality of Anchorage has a lot of shelters open and available, and they do. They do a great job for preparedness. Every school in Anchorage, as an example, is a shelter. Is set up to sustain themselves for a long period of time. As Kelly said, her operation and protocol, if it's in Anchorage and there's a school, they'll run that shelter. They're designed to not only be a school, but be a shelter for a long sustaining shelter. Mm.
And I want to pull up another quote here. Sure. And this one is from the Associated Press's Becky Bortz, also from earlier this week, timely earthquake, you guys may know. In the case of major damage to the Port of Anchorage, through which an estimated 90% of commodities for most Alaskans enter the state, there would be a cascading effect. Steve, this is a point that's been coming up a lot lately, and I wonder if you could start out by just explaining what that cascading effect alluded to would be.
Sure. Well, we call it the Port of Anchorage because of geographically where it's located. I could argue that it's really the Port of Alaska at Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Our customer base runs all the way from the North Slope all the way down to Homer, and in some instances, even Kodiak and down in the southeast. Some amount of those commodities that cross our docks wind up in all of those communities. The lion's share of it stays along the rail belt, admittedly, but things like aviation gasoline that comes into the Port of Anchorage makes its way to everywhere there are people flying their little airplanes. I had in my office the other day the Alaska director for Walmart, and he packs containers and for Kodiak, for his Walmart store in Kodiak here in Anchorage, and they go from Anchorage on one of the container carriers down to Kodiak. So a burp here is huge. A great example is the last few weeks we've been down one container ship a week because the ship's had a mechanical problem. And there have been stories in the news about store shelves in Fairbanks and down on the Kenai that don't have product for one out of four container ships that usually call here weekly. Imagine if it was two or three or four.
So not to speed over the precipice, but then what happens if the Port of Anchorage is knocked out?
Well, that's why we keep in very close contact with Mike and his people, and we plan for just that what if, as do the tenants at the port. I don't want to sell them short either. Right. The folks that conduct commerce in this state are committed to having their contingency plans as well. Things will eventually begin to make their way up here. It certainly won't be as fast or in the quantities that can be managed by a port that's been constructed to handle large quantities efficiently. But eventually things will be making their way. And you know, the challenge will be for those of us in the logistics planning world to figure out where the best place to go next is. I mean, is every port in as big a have as big a problem as Anchorage does? Are the roads intact? Are the bridges intact?
Right.
Is rail intact? Mm-hmm. I mean, all of that has to be figured out and assessed before you can figure out what your plan for recovery is going to be.
It sounds like the most terrifying chess game imaginable, where you're thinking
12
steps
ahead. As Steve said, we've planned this before. We've exercised it last year in the Alaska Shield 2014 exercise. And like I said, it was a logistics exercise, and the port is down. Okay, what are our options from there? How do we get goods and professionals in here, emergency responders in here, to stabilize the situation?
Well, and I want to get back to that, mm-hmm. of the logistics and the planning, sure. and how that work happens before time. But before we do, Kelly, what is Red Cross's profile like in Alaska, and how does it compare to other states, you know, where you guys have a presence?
We have 17 staff statewide in the American Red Cross of Alaska. So we do quite a bit of work with a little workforce. We are volunteer-led, so we have 600 volunteers across the state, and about 250 of those are work for the Disaster Services Program. They do a variety of things, whether it's responding to the single-family fires that happen in the middle of the night, and where our volunteers show up and make sure that the families have a safe place to go, some financial assistance for food and clothing and medications and things like this. But we also have a lot of preparedness campaigns that they work on. And how that compares to other regions or other states is our population just really doesn't, you know, drive the volunteerism that we see in other areas. So and the frequency of disasters seems to be higher where there is more population. Mm. So,
and how does how do nonprofits fit in with the patchwork of different federal and state and local agencies that spring into action when a disaster and emergency happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, the American Red Cross is a co-lead for all mass care activities with FEMA.
What is a mass care?
Mass care is sheltering, feeding, bulk distribution, safe and well, family reunification. So we work hand in hand with FEMA on a national level just to make sure that all of our shelter plans and evacuation plans are in place. And then on a local level, we work really closely with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to come up with the state plans of how we are going to respond to that catastrophic earthquake or other smaller events. Mm. And we work hand in hand at least once a year on something that could be a state declared disaster. Sure. Or
the
becomes
fires.
A state.
Yep. Yep.
Floods,
absolutely.
Fires.
It doesn't seem like there's a lack of opportunities to practice.
Right.
No,
that's,
since statehood, Zach, Alaska's had an event, a declared event every 90 days on average.
Yeah.
So whether it be a flood, a fire, a volcano, an avalanche that cuts off resource supplies and power.
So that gets into a question about kind of geography and location that I want to ask. Yeah. And to do that, there's one last quote that I do want to put up here. It's from Emergency Management Magazine. Your subscription may have lapsed. Mine is still intact. It says, the state's geography adds to the challenge. The whole state is far away from the sources of most goods it imports. And within Alaska, many people live in remote areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Mike, between the distance and the lack of roads and just hundreds of small communities distributed across the state, how do you guys stand a chance of doing your jobs?
Sure. I think outreach and information is key. So getting Alaskans, individuals, families, neighborhoods better prepared, mm-hmm. to be on their own for an extended period of time, knowing that the big help is not going to arrive for 7 to 10 days, if that, depending on upon the situation. We've got to take care of ourselves. Don't expect the government to show up and provide food right away. As Alaskans, we have a rich tradition of taking care of ourselves and being on our own. Where we want to get to is those folks that haven't been here for a long time, that haven't experienced that 7.1 earthquake, and let's really reflect and say, okay, are we really prepared? Do I have a disaster kit? Do I have an exit plan? Do I have a communications plan? And have I talked to my family about it? Yeah. Have we sat down at the dinner table and said, hey, what do we do in a situation like that? And work it out. And that's the strategy by which we will be better prepared as Alaskans.
Well, and that, to me, though, that brings up an interesting question of resources. And, Kelly, I kind of am curious to get your take on this, but anybody can chime in. Because a lot of that just depends on having resources, having money to provision ahead of time and plan, having communities that have their issues together enough, having a state that can kind of forward load some of those resources and plan for stuff and run drills. If in resource-scarce communities or the state, given the budget outlook, how does preparedness take a hit in that case?
Well, we will respond to disasters in every community. In some communities, we might not have a presence there at all. But we are fortunate in that we can rely on our nationwide organization to fall back on. You know, in cases that we don't have the resources somewhere, we can send resources from another location.
Yeah, and we also have great relationships. Alaska is a small town, so we've got great partnerships, as Steve and Kelly have alluded to. We've got great partnerships with our federal agencies, all of the state, local, federal, non-governmental volunteer agencies here in Alaska. So we pull together as Alaskans first, and then we've got great communications and collaboration with FEMA to say, okay, here's what we need now. These are the priorities that we need, and that comes. But it's going to come over time.
So the state plays lead in most
That's
of these
right.
scenarios.
So right? The state is the lead coordinator for response operations for disaster. And then through our partnerships, we get those resources where they need to be.
And Steve, how does a utility, I say utility, but the port is so many things to so many of us. But how do you guys plan for disasters? Is it sort of like a one-off occasion once a year, or is it like a fire drill that you're regularly running through? How do you
sure.
guys stay prepared?
Well, we have a couple of big exercises each year. One of the things that geographically challenges us at the port is that there's only one way in and one way out. We've entered into agreements with Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, which is our neighbor, to practice an evacuation on an annual basis. So we do that. And then we also have other exercises and bring some of the local community in. A good example is 3 weeks ago, we did a tabletop petroleum tank fire exercise. It was facilitated by the city's emergency management center. And we brought all the players together, fire, police, the local community in very close proximity to a lot of those tanks, and the port, and a couple of the port tenants who would have been very closely involved in that. And we sat around for the better part of 3 hours to talk out how we would all respond to this. Red Cross was there. The Anchorage School District participated. There's nobody who's immune from feeling an effect from something happening somewhere. And we just kind of convinced ourselves of that fact in this little exercise. But we spend a lot of time thinking about those things and planning for those kinds of things. And every exercise, you learn something new. Mm-hmm. You really do.
And this is a question for all three of you, but Mike, I want to start with you. what scenarios keep you up at night?
Sure. An earthquake, a sizable earthquake, with a tsunami in the wintertime in the middle of the night. Those no-notice events. Usually, as opposed to a hurricane down in the lower 48, you've got time, you know it's coming, you can prepare. These are no-notice events that could affect communities within minutes. So we work with those vulnerable communities, those tsunami, coastal, vulnerable communities to make sure their alert and warning systems are operational and they've got a great quick response plan. But it all falls back to individual preparedness. If you're down in Homer and you feel the earth shake, drop cover and hold on for a period of time until the shaking stops, and then get to high ground. And in those tsunami-ready communities, they have exit signs of where the tsunami evacuation routes would be. Follow them, get to them as quickly as possible. Don't wait for the announcements to be made. That type of information we're getting out to the general public so that they as individuals, as Alaskans, or visitors would be better prepared for that.
And Kelly, your personal nightmare?
Well, he described one of them pretty well. But I would have to also go with a single family fire, just having my own house burn down or
really?
Friends. Wow. That is the most frequent disaster that happens. Right. And we respond at the Red Cross to every single family fire, apartment fire. We've had over 200, in 2015. In the state of Alaska.
Yeah.
So it does, it keeps me up at night. I make sure that we have working smoke alarms, and everybody should do that, that my family knows where we're gonna meet and how to stay safe and get out and evacuate from the house very quickly. So we have a plan. We also have a program that is dedicated to teaching people about that preparedness and safety. And we go into homes and install smoke detectors so that people can get out fairly quickly.
Right.
But yeah.
Steve, I don't want to leave you out. What terrifies you?
Well, there's the leader on my list is without doubt the condition of the dock. When the 64 earthquake occurred, the Port of Anchorage was 3 years old. Mm-hmm. We're pushing 54 years old now, and it's beginning to show its age. We spend quite a bit of money every year doing repairs to corroding pilings that don't do anything to give us any more earthquake protection. They allow us to keep the facility open to support the loads that need to get put on the dock to keep operations moving.
And that's about $5 million a year maintaining,
It's about $3 million a year on the piling piece of it. But that doesn't count the fact that it's still an old port and we have storm drain collapses on pretty much an annual basis somewhere. And it's just infrastructure that needs a lot of upkeep. And that's what we owe the port users who really do move all this cargo in support of the state.
Just very quickly, you mentioned aviation fuel or jet fuel that comes in. About 95%, I think, of the state's...
95% of all the refined petroleum that comes into the South Central Alaska comes across the docks in Anchorage, and it covers the gamut of heating oil, low sulfur diesel, high sulfur diesel, commercial grade jet fuel, military jet fuel, and aviation gas.
I'm just curious in that scenario, though, if the port were to be knocked out, does that mean that that commercial and cargo and military jets would lose backhaul capacity?
Yes.
So, it's
a great point, and we look at these cascading effects all the time, and we run scenarios and try and pre-plan for those types of events, and working with the private sector, working with immediate response through FEMA, through Department of Defense, getting vital resources here quickly. That would at least help stabilize the situation.
And it's while it's not the only place where you could offload fuel, it's I will argue the only place where you can do it at the rate you would need to keep up with some kind of disaster response responsibilities. After that, and then it's right there at the heart of things. You don't have to truck it in or fly it in.
And the capacity that the port brings in, trying to duplicate that over air or over the road is something that the infrastructure, the road system, can't handle. And so we've done a lot of studying as far as the impacts of the infrastructure on a situation like this.
I mean, the next best equipped port is Whittier, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And that's about 10 or 15% of cargo.
Well, if the road is available. So, you know,
and the tunnel's open.
That's right. So there are spider webs of single points of failure that we have to really look at based upon the situation. What is the puzzle? What does it look like? And what are our options from there?
I could stay mired in this
calamitous thinking for
hours, but I do, Kelly. I wanted to go back to what you'd said about your fire answer, and I mean, just even at a household level, what is good preparedness or kind of disaster ready training that you guys try to get people equipped for?
Well, kitchen fires being the most common house fire cause, we just teach people to think about, you know, safe cooking and making sure that they don't leave cooking unattended, making sure that people are, if they are smoking, that they do that safely and that they extinguish, you know, that safely as well. Having working smoke alarms, like I talked about, that's a really, really big one that saves lives. You only have 2 minutes to evacuate your house after a house fire and the smoke alarm starts going off, so making sure that people know how they're gonna get out and how they're gonna exit, and making sure that especially children are aware of that plan.
And how much canned soup should I stockpile before I know that it's, you know, I've got enough?
I don't know, you might just hit the shelves of Costco and just get as much as you can, really. No.
You have a lot of soup?
I do. I have a lot of soup.
That's okay.
A lot of sodium.
It's some sort of hydration, but there's some sodium involved.
But I mean, you guys mentioned 7 days. I know there's been an effort in Anchorage and I think across the state to kind of get people every month to kind of put something away.
So I'm going to throw a pitch, Zach. So www.ready.alaska.gov. is our website, and we've got some very simple, very easy to work through preparedness guides, which over 12 weeks you go to the store, you pick a couple of things up, you have enough food for 7 days, you have enough water for 7 days for you or your family, for your pet considerations, very simple, easy to follow guidelines that will help you be better prepared, not just soup, because I'm sure you get tired of soup over 7 days.
It's like an advent calendar.
It is, in a way. It's very, very easy flip chart, you know, and then also for the window, I'm okay. or I need help. Mm-hmm. So,
and just again, I mean, I think it's an interesting mentality that you guys bring, that it's to, you know, don't expect for a rescue to happen right away, mm-hmm. but to, you know, is that a kind of difference in thinking than from what people might expect when they see television footage of Marines dropping?
Yeah, I think you know, it's the Alaska way. It's the Alaska way. We take care of ourselves. We take care of our neighbors. So not only just talking about it, being prepared and having a supply, but having the conversation with your family, having the conversation with your neighborhood, understanding, you know, who might be needing some extra help. Mm-hmm. So if you're okay and your family's okay, go check on your neighbors. Mm-hmm. If there's a nurse in the neighborhood, that, you know, that's an advantage to your, to the rest of your neighbors. Get a neighborhood group together to walk that walk. Go, okay, if something like this happens, who would be responsible for what, and that will help us all be better prepared.
I don't think we could end it on a better note, but that is all the time that we have here on Alaska Edition. Thank you to all three of my guests, Steve Rabuffo with the Port, Kelly McGuirk with Red Cross, and Mike O'Hare with Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And thank you at home for joining us as well. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.